Hello there. This is Paul Nagy, and you are listening to WCOM in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Carrboro. We are communityradio.coop on your internet. I want to tell you about something that's coming up locally. It is that WCOM 103.5, which you may be listening to right now if you're hearing my voice, and the Arts Center of Carrboro is presenting a big musical benefit weekend. It's for this radio station, and it's Saturday and Sunday, January 4th and 5th. All proceeds from this two-night event will go to support this radio station, WCOM. The final Friday lineup features the Nashville Americana band Missy Raines and the New Hip, the Ramblers, and the Club Boheme. On Saturday night, Hard Rock Steel Band is going to be there with the Allen Boys, and Mount Airy will perform along with Django Haskins and Lucy Summers. And the second, third, both shows begin at 8:30. Tickets are on sale now and can be purchased at the Art Center or online at www.artcenterlive.org. That's www.artscenterlive.org. The weekend kicks off the Art Center's annual American Roots Series. Please come out for two of our great evenings of music and support WCOM and Community Radio. I'm Paul Nagy, and the show that's about to start is called Touchstones Religious Experience. We focus upon religious experience, spiritual experience, as it is reflected in our community, which, to be honest with you folks, is extremely diverse and a wonderful possibility. In the next shows, this one and the next couple of ones, we're going to be taking a slightly different tract as far as how we're going to be setting up the show. Today, my guest is Philip Young, who is recently retired from the
University of North Carolina.
Chapel Hill, right? Yes. Okay. That big institution on the hill here.
That's the one.
That's right. Yeah, we're down here in the stockyards of Carrboro, reflecting on the eternal verities that they question in the academy these days. And we're going to be reflecting on two themes. We have two themes for today's show. The first is a recognition, a little late, but still a good recognition, of Jalaluddin Rumi, the Persian poet who lived in the, who died in a little over 750 years ago, but whose birthday was this year, his 800th birthday was celebrated this year. But his death day, which is was December 17th, is called as Urs. The Urs is the nuptial night of when the mystic sheds his body for the last time and flies uninhibitedly to join in eternal nuptial union with the divine. It is death for the mystic is sublime, where for us lesser folk or people of lesser certainty, a lesser knowledge, lesser appreciation, will find it more difficult. We're going to share some poetry from Jalaluddin Rumi. And then the second part of our show, which will be the shorter part of our show, we're going to reflect upon the horoscope of Chapel Hill. And we're also going to be considering the end of the Mayan calendar, which is officially the winter solstice of the year 2012, which is an interesting alignment where our solar system becomes aligned with the center of the Milky Way galaxy. That's an astronomical event. And we are going to be talking about 2012 as a initiating time for the 27,000-year cycle of the precession of the equinoxes. It's very possible that human beings have been floating around on the Earth for a good 500,000 years, that us Sapiens became sapiens sometime sooner rather than later. A million years, we probably weren't talking too well back then. But by the time 500,000 years went around, we were working hard at trying to become civilized. Well, we became civilized not that long ago, less than 20,000 years ago. And in that time, we have managed to almost wreck the planet we live upon. So it might be time at this point to consider taking a new leaf on how to live with one another and how to live in harmony with our natural environment. That apparently is the possible meaning of this cosmic event, which some of us will have the privilege to live through. No, people, Gabriel is not going to be blowing his horns that particular day. We're not talking the immediate beginning of the rapture or any of those other final days that we can put it. We're talking about a major generational civilizational shift that's taking place. And I think this kind of millenarianism, where one considers that there are events and choices that really only have an opportunity to take place in sort of in a developmental scheme. You know, when you're a kid, if you don't learn how to speak, if you aren't around speakers before you're 5 years old, if you're raised in a mute environment, you will never develop the full facility for language. This is almost a kind of programming that'll take place in your brain, is that the ways that we make sounds and also the ways that we can connect sounds to meaning and that meaning to create language, we have to learn it at a certain point in our neurological development, or we don't learn it very well at all. This is one of the things that we've learned from feral children. Well, we may be at one of those points in our development as a species where if we're going to survive and live well on the planet, it may be that we have to decide that there are some very major types of things that we need to do differently. And it probably has to do with the environment. That seems to be all the talking heads that deal with this topic of 2012 and the end of the Mayan calendar, what it possibly means, are pretty much in unison that it means that we got to get along with one another and we got to get along with our natural world in a sustainable way. But now, back from, as it were, the ridiculous and the sublime, let us consider Jalaluddin Rumi. Philip, do you have a poem you'd like to share from him?
I do, actually.
You gotta speak closer to your microphone.
Speak closer to the microphone. There. How's that? Is that better, Paul?
Right.
Yes, actually, I have a few, and was enjoying reading some more of the poetry this morning, and I'll be happy to share one of the pieces that stood out for me. This one is entitled "You Are As You Are," and the book that I'm reading from is Rumi, translated by Coleman Barks, and the title of it is "The Glance: Songs of Soul Meeting." Yesterday, you made a promise. Today, you broke it. Yesterday, Bastami's dance. Today, dregs thrown out. In pieces, and at the same time, a perfect glass filled with sunlight. Give up on figuring the appearances, the dressing in green like a Sufi. You don't resemble anyone. You're not the bride or the groom. You don't fit in a house with a family. You've left the closed-in corner where you lived. Domestic animals get ridden to work, not you. You are as you are, an indescribable message coming on the air. Every word you say, medicine. But not yet. Stay quiet and still.
Thank you, Philip. We're reading poetry from Jalaluddin Rumi. I've decided to take a slightly different tack. Coleman Barks is a wonderful guy, recently retired as a professor from Athens, Georgia, where he taught English for many years. And he spent many years adapting Rumi's poetry to a current poetic idiom. I mean, Rumi's poetry is incredibly rich in imagery and in things. And so even a few lines of his poetry and his longer poetry is very adaptable to shorter poetic forms. And that's pretty much what Coleman Barks has done, so much so that he has become the best-selling poet in America, mainly Coleman Barks's versions of Rumi's poetry, sells more poetry than most contemporary poets. It speaks to the heart. It speaks to the universal experience of human beings. However, Rumi himself was a Sufi, which means that he was a Muslim mystic. He lived at a time when he was born in Afghanistan and then emigrated with his father west, where he ended up in Konya. And Konya is on the Anatolian Plateau in what today is modern-day Turkey. It was known as Iconium in the Roman times. And in fact, his name that we know him by, Rumi, is actually means Roman and means which was what they called Byzantine, or what was known later as Constantinople and as Istanbul today. It was the second Rome, and was founded as such. However, so much for the history lessons. The reason that they had to immigrate was there was a thing called the Mongol hordes were coming down, and they were pretty rough on the Muslims. They literally slaughtered tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people for several generations. And they eventually converted to Islam, but before that happened, the Muslim cities, including the capital, which was Baghdad at the time, was overrun by the Mongol hordes, and the city was sacked. And it ended in some ways some of the golden age of the Islamic civilization, and caused the beginning of certain major changes. Rumi lived with his father and grew up as a young man in Konya, where he was. He lived as a jurist and lived a relatively simple life, but he lived a regal life as far as his being raised as a Sufi from childhood. And his poetry, he spoke his poetry. His poetry is written down by his auditors, by the people who were around him. And is best known for a work called the Mathnawi. The Mathnawi is a Persian poem. It's very well known in Persia. It's called the Quran in Persia. It is a wonderful collection of folk tale and didactic poetry that to this day can rarely be seen. But one of the things that most people seem to overlook in reading some of the great poetry is some of the ideas that fit underneath it. And it's to that I want to address. And the work I'm using, I'm going to be reading from, is probably the best introduction to the spiritual teachings of Jalaluddin Rumi by William Chittick. And it's called The Sufi Path of Love. It's by William Chittick, who's up in New York. Rumi has nothing but pity and disdain for those who look at the world around and within themselves and do not understand that what they are seeing is a veil over reality. The world is a dream, a prison, a trap, foam thrown up from the ocean, dust kicked up by the passing horse, but it is not what it appears to be. Quote, if everything that appears to us were just as it appears, the prophet, who was endowed with such penetrating vision, both illuminated and illuminating, would never have cried out, O Lord, show us things as they are. Rumi draws a fundamental distinction between form and meaning. Form is the thing's outward appearance, meaning its inward and unseen reality. Ultimately, meaning is that thing as it is known to God in God's self, and since God is beyond any sort of multiplicity, in the last analysis, the meaning of all things is God. Form is shadow, meaning the sun. And to quote some of the verses from Rumi, in the face of meaning, what is form? Very contemptible. The meaning of the heavens keeps them in place. The meaning of the wind makes it wander like a mill wheel, captive to the water of the stream. Know that the outward form passes away, but the world of meaning remains forever. How long will you make love with the shape of the jug? Leave aside the jug's shape. Go seek water. Having seen the form, you are unaware of the meaning. If you are wise, pick out the pearl from the shell. Philip, do you have something you want to share?
Well, the book that I purchased and enjoyed talked about, of course, this poetry that Barks wanted to deal with, dealt with the relationship that Rumi had with Shams. And, of course, the poetry tries to address the mystical relationship that people can share with one another in a variety of different ways. And so I am always appreciative of someone like Rumi who is trying to remind people that we think in patterns, and breaking out of those patterns is a process that is extremely valuable. And so I found in the poetry that opportunity to break with patterns and to make us aware of patterns. And so we become aware of our own entrapment. And that's the beauty of poetry that really touches the soul. But I did enjoy that Barks decided to collect a group of poems that addressed how we are interconnected as human beings. And referring back to the point that you're talking about with where we are in the world right now, a need to recognize our interconnectedness and think about what that means in terms of the world that we create. So I'm impressed. I found another poem that really, again, spoke to me that I think addresses this issue of connection with others. And the title of it is, I See My Beauty in You. And it goes, I see my beauty in you. I become a mirror that cannot close its eyes to your longing. My eyes wet with yours in the early light. My mind every moment giving birth, always conceiving, always in the ninth month, always the come point. How do I stand this? We become these words we say, a wailing sound moving out into the air. These thousands of worlds that rise from nowhere, how does your face contain them? I'm a fly in your honey, then closer, a moth caught in flame's allure, then empty sky stretched out in homage.
Yes, Philip, thank you. The relationship between Rumi and Shamsi Tabriz is one of the great stories that comes out of the Middle East, and everyone who has any appreciation of Rumi should know the story of... it's sort of... one of the ways that one can see it is that their relationship took Rumi, who was definitely a man of his time, who was culturally well-integrated, and, you know, a good Muslim. He was always a good Muslim.
A bit of an academic, in fact.
Yes, definitely an academic. He made his living giving decisions on the nature of the law, which was a modest living. Any money that was given to him by royalty and gifts, he actually had a corporation that distributed it to the poor. He didn't even distribute it himself or attempt to. And he lived a very simple life. Shemzy DeBreeze lived even a more of a simple life. He was sort of a roustabout, again, a Sufi, and a very learned in the science of the Sufis, of prayer and contemplation. But he didn't have any class and didn't have any royal patronage, and apparently was sort of a blue-collar fellow as opposed to the white-collar Rumi. And when he came to town, Rumi spotted him in the marketplace. Now, he had been praying for years that he wanted to know another human being who had the same burning flame for the divine. This was Rumi's prayer, his secret heart prayer to the divine. And when he saw Shems, he saw the possibility. He saw not just another flame, but the sun. And in their relationship, as we have Rumi's report of it, he was turned into a man of his time to a man of all times. And one of the reasons why his poetry still speaks to us across cultures, across great divides, is because he embraced all of human experience and brought it and cooked it in this incredible, intense love, divine love, but divine love realized in the gaze of another human being.
I think in a way to simplify that perhaps for people is, it's when you meet someone that gets you. It's I think what we all hope for in any relationship, friendships, relationship with parents, relationship with lovers, is to find people who, when they look at us, they get us entirely as who we are, and we are able to get them as well. And so in reading the poetry, I found many of the descriptions that he uses is to say that when I look at you, I look out from your eyes. And so there is no real separation, and yet there's still distinction there. And I think that's what's an amazing effort that we all want in terms of connection and humanity.
Yeah, and I want to continue with the form distinction here. We're working on several levels at the same time, folk, but I want to bring this, play around with this form distinction a little bit. The world, then, is form, or a collection of myriad forms. By its very nature, each form displays its own meaning, which is its reality with the divine. If a person's task is not to be deceived by form, they must understand that the form does not exist for its own sake, but manifests a meaning above and beyond itself. Forms are the oil, meaning the light, otherwise you would not keep asking why. If form is for the sake of the form itself, why ask why? So wisdom cannot allow that the outward forms of the heaven and the inhabitants of the earth should exist for this only. Pass beyond form. Escape from names. Flee from titles and names towards meaning. The prophet said, "Behold, the form of the heavens and the earth, and through this the form draw benefit from the universal meaning. For you see the changes wrought by the wheel of heaven, and the rain of clouds and the seasons, summer and winter, and the changes of time. You see that everything is in its place and in accordance with wisdom. After all, how does an inanimate cloud know that it must send down rain in season? You see the earth, how it nourishes plants and makes them into 10. Well, someone does this. See him by means of this world, and take replenishment from him, just as you take replenishment from the meaning of the human reality through the body. Take replenishment from the meaning of the world and the form's form. The dichotomy between meaning and form is a mainstay of Rumi's teachings, but must not be kept constantly and must be kept constantly in mind. He refers to it in many different contexts, and through a great variety of images and symbols. In fact, there is no overriding reason to label the fundamental dichotomy within reality as between form and meaning, except that the pair of terms seems to be the widest in application of all of Pear's Rumi employees, and he probably refers to it more often than any other. In any case, we should not attempt to tie Rumi down too closely to in the matter of terminology. After all, he is a poet. Meaning, by definition, is beyond form and its constructions. Therefore, all attempts to express it in words must be equivocal to some extent. Rather than impose strict philosophical definitions on Rumi's terminology, we'd be much better off letting him speak for himself as he urges the reader to go beyond definitions and the limitations of human language. Rumi often discusses the meaning of form dichotomy in terms drawn from philosophical usage, even more often in the images of symbols of poetry. A few of the terms he pairs together most commonly are secondary causes, the first cause, outward, the inward, dust and wind, foam and ocean, pitcher and painter, shadow and light. Philip, do you have another poem you'd like to share?
Well, it's interesting that what you were reading, the piece that I wanted to read next, I think has a nice synchronicity for what you were saying. The title of this one is Undressing. Learn the alchemy true human beings know. The moment you accept what troubles you've been given, the door will open. Welcome difficulty as a familiar comrade. Joke with torment brought by the friend. Sorrows are the rags of old clothes and jackets that serve to cover, then are taken off. That undressing and the naked body underneath is the sweetness that comes after grief.
Thank you. In referring to form and meaning, or the outward and the inward, Rumi employs another set of terms which emphasizes the negative face of meaning in relationship to the positive side of form. From this point of view, then, place and meaning is no place. Foam is color and sea is colorlessness, for meaning is opposite to form and can be attained by form's negation, by formlessness. Everyone has turned his face towards some... nor that. He manifests himself in place, but in truth he has no place. You are from place, but your origin is no place. Close down this shop and open up that shop. How long will you give signs? Silence, for the origin of signs has no sign. Colorness is the root of all colors, peace the root of all wars. Colorlessness is the root of colors. Pictureless is the root of pictures. Wholeness is the root of words, and the mind of the root of coins. So behold, thousands of colors have come from the vat, which transcends the blue and the white. Forms come into existence from the formless, just as smoke is born from fire. Lord of lords, formless giver of forms, what form art thou putting over me? Thou knowest I know not. Rumi often discerns between form and meaning in terms of existence and non-existence. This pairing of terms is more complicated than many of the others, since each of the two words may either refer to form or to meaning, depending upon the context. From one point of view, we see the world as an existent thing, hence form is existence, while the meaning is formless and non-existent. But we should look carefully and see that this form or existence is but dust upon the wind. Compared to the ocean, the form may truly be called non-existent. So from a second point of view, God and meaning are existence, while form and the world are non-existent. Rumi often contrasts these two points of view in the same verses, and in other times he refers to one view or the other. Here's an example. This world of non-existence appears as existent things, and the world of existence is exceedingly hidden. Dust is upon the wind playing deceptive. It sets up a veil, which is doing the work, has no work. It is only skin, but that which is hidden is the kernel and the origin. We and our existences are non-existences. Thou art absolute existence, showing thyself in perishable things. We are all lions, but lions on a banner. We keep on leaping because of the wind. The worldly man imagines that a non-existent thing possesses splendor. Oh, friend, why would a wise man devote his life to the work of non-existence? Because of the darkness in your eyes, you imagine that a nothing is a something. Your eyes can be made healthy and illumined, and the dust of the king's doorstep. Form and meaning are inextricably connected. Form derives from meaning. Meaning manifests itself through a form. Since the two are outward and inward aspects of a single reality, each is important in its own way. But for most people, the danger lies in giving too much importance to form and not understanding that it derives its existence and significance from meaning. Again, I am citing the beginning of The Sufi Path of Love by William Chittick. And Philip, do you got something you'd like to share?
I do. First, I'd like to say something about the last part of what you said. It reflects in me what I've observed among people today is a search for spirituality. We certainly have plenty of form in the sense that we have modernized medicine to extend our lives. We have created ease, comfort. We have access to many things, especially here in the States, of course, where we have great wealth. And yet there still seems to be struggle with people at the soul level. And I think Rumi speaks to addressing that for people saying, you know, what is the value? What is it that you see as being most important and why? And do you find that in the things you possess, or do you find that in the truth of who you are? The piece that I stumbled upon, I was sort of flipping through, I enjoy just sort of following the thumbs, is one entitled What's Not Here. I think this is a shorter version of what Paul just read. I start out on this road, call it love or emptiness. I only know what's not here. Resentment seeds, back-scratching greed, worrying about outcomes, fear of people. When a bird gets free, it doesn't go back for remnants left on the bottom of the cage. Close by, I'm rain. Far off, a cloud of fire. I seem restless, but I am deeply at ease. Branches tremble, the roots are still. I am a universe in a handful of dirt, whole when totally demolished. Talk about choices does not apply to me. While intelligence considers options, I am somewhere lost in the wind.
When you say that form is the branch of meaning, or form is the vassal, while the heart is the king, all form and meaning are relative terms. You say, this is the branch of that. If there were no branch, how could you call the other the root? So it becomes the root, becomes the branch. If there were no branch, it would have no name. Just as Rumi constantly distinguishes between form and meaning, he also refers over and over again to two kinds of knowledge and vision. One that discerns only form, and the other that passes beyond form and discerns the meaning. The first he sometimes calls the science of the bodies, and he distinguishes it from the science of religions. The former embraces all that we customarily understand by the terms of science and knowledge, even such disciplines as theology and metaphysics. For these are learned by rote and study, until they boil up from the heart as the result of direct vision of the inward meaning of realities or from God and God's self. There are but shadows, not light, without a direct and vibrant living vision of the meaning, knowledge is only form. Certainly, it may have the potentiality of being transmuted into true knowledge, but only after long spiritual travail. The person more perfect in erudition is beyond the meaning and ahead in form. A knowledge is needed whose root is upon the other side, since every branch leads to its root. Every wing cannot fly across the breadth of the ocean. Only a knowledge that comes directly from God can take one to God. Every science acquired by study and effort in this world is the science of bodies, but the science acquired after death is the science of religions. Knowing the science of I am God is the science of bodies, but becoming I am God is the science of religions. To see the light of a lamp or a fire in the science of bodies is to be consumed by the fire of the light, or the lamp is the science of religions. Whatever is vision is the science of religions. Whatever is knowledge is the science of bodies. These people who have studied and are now studying imagine that they have attained faithfully here what they forget, and abandon that all their knowledge. On the contrary, when they come here, their sciences all acquire a spirit. The sciences are all painting. They all gain spirits. It is as if lifeless bodies received a spirit. The root of all these sciences is from the beyond, but they have been transported from the world without sounds and letters into the world of sounds and letters. I think that this understanding the science of religions is a good critique within Islam, and Rumi was definitely a Muslim. We have a critique of the various fundamentalisms that have created the various aspects of Islamicism that has infected the world with fanaticism and fear, and which Muslims themselves must struggle with. They have, within their own classical heritage, an antidote to the false certainties and the rigor and threat of violence that exists within Muslim religion, in the extremes of Muslim religion today. Likewise, Christians have the same anecdote to the fundamentalisms and the certainties and the arrogance of aspects of the religion that divides people from people. In the example of Jesus, in his being who hung out with tax collectors and prostitutes, who welcomed everyone to the table, and who was perfectly willing to mingle with all within his own community. So it is, Philip?
I was just going to say, if we deeply accept the specialness of humanity, divinity, if you would prefer to use that word, then we have to recognize we have a lot more work to do. And I think what Rumi exposes for us is how deeply do we believe those possibilities? And what's changed for humanity now from the time that Rumi was writing is an opening up for access for everyone. I mean, we do have to remember the historical period, the context, and the context of the time would have been very limiting for only a few to have access to even books or to have access to academic knowledge of some sort. But now, with the internet, with the information age, we need to convert the information age into the wisdom age at some point.
Yes, folks, and the wisdom will not be found on the internet, only its promise and its shadow. Ultimately, what Rumi is primarily and forcefully, he is a poet of love. He is definitely the Shakespeare of Persian. His language is rich and ever shifting, full of passion and life, full of promise. And in many ways, Rumi is more alive today than when he was alive as a man and spoke. And I would like to share some of his thinking on about love. When someone hears that in a certain city a generous man is bestowing tremendous gifts and bounties, naturally he will go there in hopes of receiving a share. Since God's bounty is so famous and the whole world knows about God's kindness, why do we not beg from him? Why do you not desire robes of honor and purses of gold? You sit in indolence and say, if he wants to, he will give me something. And you do not make a request. You look at the dog, which has neither intellect nor comprehension. When hungry and without food, it comes to you and wags its tail. And it means, of course, give me food. Since I have no food and you have some, it has this much discernment. Why don't we? Now, really, you are not less than a dog, which is not content to sleep in the ashes and say, he wants to, but he will give me some food. It barks and wags its tail. And you also wag your tail and ask from God, beg, for in this face is such a benefactor. Begging is tremendously desirable. Since you have no good fortune, ask for it from someone who is not a niggard and possesses great wealth. They say that in the end, love is the want and need for something. Hence, need is the root and the needed the thing in the branch. I say, after all, when you speak out of need. Your need brings your words into existence. Since your desired words, they came into being. So need is prior, and the words came into being from it. Hence, need existed without the words, and love and need cannot be the words' branches. Someone said, but the goal of the need was the words. How can the goal be the branch? And the master answered, the branch is always the goal. The tree's roots exist for the sake of the branches. Almighty God does not bestow anything without need. Had there been no need for the world, the Lord of the world's inhabitants would not have created it. It is this quaking earth. Had no need for mountains, would he have created them in their majesty? Had there not been need for the spears, he would not have brought the seven heavens into from non-existence. The sun, the moon, the stars, how could they have come visibly into existence had there been no need? So the noose of all existence is need. Man's instrument is the extent of his need. Need, love. Love, then, is a response to our need. Our need is non-existence, and love is our existence. And so it is in Rumi. The religion of love. Love's creed is separate from all religions. The creed and denomination of lovers is God. When there is a pilgrimage of the heavens, non-existence. The religion and creed of lovers is non-existence. My religion is to live through love. Life through this spirit and body are but a shame. The intellect does not know and is bewildered by the religion of love, even if it should be aware of all religions. In the religion of the lovers, the spirit is mortally ill, whose illness does not make him worse every day. Something other than love for the most beautiful God is agony of the spirit, though it is sugar eating. What is agony of the spirit? To advance towards death without seizing hold of the water of life. The worst of all deaths is to be without love. Why does the oyster tremble? For the pearl, every breath without the beloved is a body without a head. The man far from love's snare is a bird without wings. What does he know of the universe? For he knows nothing of those who know. If love's pulse does not beat within a man, let him be Plato, he is but an ass. If a head is not full of love, the head is behind the tail. If you have not been a lover, count not your life as lived, for on the day of reckoning, it will not be counted. Any time that passes without love will be shamefaced before God. A lifetime without love is of no account. Love is the water of life. Drink it down with heart and soul. Know that all the lovers are fish without water, dead and dissected, though they be viziers. The school of love, the teacher, the Almighty, we are all students. These words are our recitation. Philip, do you have a poem you'd like to share?
Certainly. I think mine will come a little bit on the lighter side, but I found this piece and definitely brought a smile to my face, and part of it is because it's. I enjoyed the title. The title of this one is A Smile and a Gentleness. There is a smile and a gentleness inside. When I learned the name and address of that, I went to where you sell perfume. I begged you not to trouble me so with longing. Come out and play. Flirt more naturally. Teach me how to kiss. On the ground, a spread blanket, flame that's caught and burning well, cumin seeds browning. I am inside all this with my soul.
Thank you. So we have been discussing and sharing with you some insights from Jalaluddin Rumi, which probably every year around this time in December, we will be bringing Rumi back into our consciousness and into our awareness. Also, for the next 5 years or so, we are going to also be around the same time of year, are going to be bringing up the topic of 2012 as a demarcation point of the end time or the beginning time of the precession of the equinoxes. The great and wonderful recorder of New Age wisdom, Sounds True, which is a known for their audio books and courses on New Age thinking, has published a book called simply enough The Mystery of 2012, and it's currently available in bookstores around the country. It's has a number of articles by various New Age luminaries, Greg Brandon, Russell, Peter Russell, Daniel Pinchbeck, Joanna Macy, John Major Jenkins, whose work I'm going to be specifically referring to, and others. So the point here of the volume, which we're telling you to pay attention to, it's actually quite thorough in its and dealing with what would be the aspect of 2012 is quite things. Are we truly coming to an end of a cosmic cycle? Will there be an age of awakening, a new step in human evolution, or even an end of the world as we know it? For years, archaeologists have known the Mayan calendar predicts this date as the end era on the Earth. Yet today, more and more researchers, spiritual explorers, and even scientists are witnessing signs that 2012 will mark a critical shift in the history of our planet. Now, for the first time, leading authorities on the 2012 phenomena present their insights about this enigmatic date in a single book, the one we're talking about here right now, The Mystery of 2012. Features articulate and lucid essays from dozens of renowned experts on the question of 2012. The anthology offers information necessary to examine the mystery from many angles, a spiritual, economic, ecological, scientific, and to decide for yourself whether 2012 will be the end with a whimper or a bang. In The Mystery of 2012, we can discover the startling predictions and revelations prominent thinkers, such as John Major Jenkins' Journey to the Source for Answers, That is the source of the original Mayan calendar and its perennial wisdom it embodies. And other people. Philip, I know you were looking at a copy of this book, and what did you have that you wanted to share?
Well, first I'd like to let everyone know that what's interesting about the book is it really is truly a mix of essays. There are critical essays. There are essays that in many ways embrace much of the story and accept it as a given. There's an essay that argues for alien life visiting the planet. So it certainly is a good read, not only for the subject matter, but the way the subject matter is presented as an opportunity for any reader to explore different perspectives and to make decisions on their own. But clearly the theme that is persistent is that anytime we have a date that we mark as important, it creates an opportunity in our minds, just as Y2K actually created an opportunity. It, of course, didn't turn out to be quite the disaster that was considered a possibility, but it created a type of focus. And 2012, I think, as this story begins to infiltrate the common dialogue, and we're certainly contributing to that process today, maybe even encouraging a few people who, after hearing this, will go out and purchase the book for themselves and maybe share it, is, again, drawing a focal point as a way to set our minds to what task do we have at hand and what does it mean when the universe, in a way, lines up in a particular way. Does it actually mean anything? I think that's a question that comes to bear. But there are some interesting arguments and some interesting possibilities, both astronomically and geologically, that can have an impact on what we do spiritually and how we think about our behavior up to this point.
Yeah, and I want to reiterate that the winter solstice of 2012, which is when the Mayan calendar ends, does not necessarily mean that you should wake up that morning and dust off your eardrums and listen for the horn of Gabriel and expect to be taken up in the rapture, or maybe not. But the point is that we're living through a time, and it's a special time where we really do have to make some refocusing of our values. And ultimately, these are our personal values of how we live our life, and how. But beyond the personal, they are going to become necessarily more and more political and more collective. We have to become agreement that we have to live in harmony with the planet. My views tend to be more oriented towards the ecological point that we really have to realize that we cannot live the way we have with our environment and survive with such luxury as a species. We are headed for our success is creating our extinction.
Well, I'd like to share something from another book that I brought in, and a thought that what you're saying made me realize earlier this morning when I was thinking about coming out here. But first, let me read this passage. This is from the book Shamanic Experience, A Practical Guide to Psychic Powers by Kenneth Meadows, and he has a paragraph in here. He says, "Many of our most pressing environmental problems are the result of personal imbalance on a massive scale. The Earth itself is now suffering as a result of mankind's ignorance and reckless exploitation. Equilibrium can only be regained through a renewed respect for nature, the Earth, and all its inhabitants, both human and non-human. So knowledge of an ancient understanding has never been more relevant to the needs of ordinary people than it is today." And what I was thinking about this morning was human imagination, what we've been able to accomplish with human imagination. I would almost go so far as to say it is truly the God force of our consciousness. And if we can't resolve the problem by taking care of the Earth, my suspicion is that we'll figure out a way to take our behaviors beyond the Earth and colonize space in some way. And I think that's a realistic possibility if we end up destroying our natural resources. But people forget that we live on a spaceship and not an endless frontier. But we behave as if we live on an endless frontier.
Yeah, there basically is no away. We can't throw anything away. Everything we do is has a consequence to which we are accountable. Yes, I guess some people might call this karma, but in more and more ways, we're seeing that the things that we do in our society, the kinds of development that we pursue, the way we alter our environment has profound consequences. not only for ourselves, but for other living things, and that we depend upon other living things in ways that we ourselves may not yet recognize. But with their extinction, our own comfort and care may be things. We have to realize that forests have a greater value than lumber. Dead trees, though important perhaps in a very narrow way to our development, may be leading to, if we destroy our forests, we are destroying our lungs of the earth. And the way cigarettes have destroyed the lungs of many, it may be that our understanding of development in that trees will naturally regenerate is not the case. You know, I don't think people necessarily know, but if you go back to the cradle of civilization, Iraq and Mesopotamia, that in the historic times when Sumer was arising, that entire area was lush forest and some grasslands, but mostly lush forest. We chopped down all the trees, fellows. You know, we want to know why the Middle East is so much a desert is because we were so successful in our early urbanization that we destroyed all the forests in the area. Now, the people still live there, but they don't live as well as they did when they had forests. So in the same way, fellows, we need to keep our forests going. This kind of argument can be said over and over and over again. And
we certainly don't have to go very far. We certainly don't have to go around the world. When you look at the drought that NC has been experiencing, a record drought. But what it's brought to bear is the amount of water consumption. It's interesting to read articles that list exactly how many gallons of water on a daily basis a city like Durham or Raleigh or Chapel Hill actually consumes, and to be completely oblivious to it because it is a renewable resource. But now we're meeting a situation where the resource isn't renewing as quickly as possible, and now we're having to face conservation issues. And the discovery from that is really actually how much we can conserve. It's an issue that has exposed, in my own personal experience, the amount of water that I was wasting at one time because we had a well where we lived, and mm-hmm. we started to work to try to preserve the well. And in fact, our well did eventually begin to collapse, and we had to become connected to city water. But in the process of trying to save the well, I discovered many different ways in which I was wastefully using water that I tried.
That
to...
big lawn you've got, for one thing.
Well, we don't water the lawn, so that wasn't an issue for us. Fortunately, our lines from our septic system run in the backyard, so that's why our lawn survived.
Oh, say so, flush. Okay.
Every time we flushed, it was a happy lawn.
Yeah.
But also recycling did that for me. I was amazed to discover that when I became a very aggressive recycler, that I was able to reduce the number of times I took trash out from once a week to once every 3 weeks.
So I wanted to thank everyone for being here today. This is WCOM LP. We're at Chapel Hill and Carrboro, 103.5 FM on your dial. We're also can be heard through the internet on www.communityradio.coop. That's communityradio.coop. This has been Touchstones. Today I've had my guest has been Philip Young, and we have briefly been discussing the mysteries of 2012, and also sharing from William Chittick and Coleman Barks about Jalaluddin Rumi and the Sufi Path of Love. And what was the name of your book again? It was called The Glance.
The Glance. The Glance is the book of Rumi's poetry.
Yeah, and specifically on the human relationships that Rumi had with all of his poetry was spoken to in a way to a beloved, the beloved being present in Shemsi Tabriz and in several other people after him. So thank you for being here today, and we will now turn you over.
aprendió a defenderse antes de aprender a hablar. No caminaba todavía y ya sabía estar donde no estaba, porque los rayos del amor y del odio atraviesan de un salto las más espesas selvas y los ríos más hondos. Cuando los Tucuna le cortaron la cabeza, la vieja recogió en las manos su propia sangre y la sopló hacia el sol. El alma también entra en ti, gritó. Y desde entonces, el que mata recibe en el cuerpo, aunque no quiera ni sepa, el alma de su víctima.
Memoria del Fuego, de Eduardo Galeano. Una producción de la Asociación Latinoamericana de Educación Radiofónica, ALER.
Una noche tibia nos conocimos junto al agua azul de Ipacaraí. Tú cantabas triste por el camino, viejas melodías en guaraní, y con el embrujo de tus canciones iba renaciendo tu amor en mí. Y en la noche hermosa de plenilunio, de tu blanca mano sentí el calor, y con tus ojazos me dio el amor. ¿Dónde estás ahora, cuñataí? Suave canto no llega a mí. ¿Dónde estás ahora? Mi ser te añora con frenesí.